This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark, and today I have on the line with me Laura Spinney, science journalist and author. Her latest book is titled Pale Rider, The Spanish Flu of 1918 and How It Changed the World. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, Laura.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So first of all, let's talk a bit about the Spanish flu. I mean, I think a lot of people are a lot more aware of what this was and what happened in 1918, but maybe give us a little bit more of an in-depth understanding what actually happened in 1918.
So it was an influenza pandemic that emerged in the early months of 1918 and swept over the world in three waves. The very last cases probably weren't recorded until 1921, so we can say it lasted a little over 3 years. It infected, in total, we estimate 1 in 3 people on Earth, or 500 million people at the time. And the numbers that we tend to work with today suggest that between 50 and 100 million of those people died. So that equates to 2.5 to 5% of the global population at that time. And just to put those numbers in perspective, the First World War, with which the pandemic overlapped, is estimated to have killed around 18 million people, and the Second World War, around 50 or 60 million people. So the 1918 flu pandemic was probably worse than both of those put together. It was undeniably the worst catastrophe of the 20th century, and perhaps the worst catastrophe in modern human history.
A lot of people have drawn comparisons between the Spanish flu and the COVID-19 pandemic that we're experiencing now, referencing some of your articles that you were writing when the pandemic was first starting to take on its final form, so to speak. You cast some doubt over whether or not the Spanish flu would be a good comparison for COVID-19. What do you think of it now? Is it a good comparison?
Not in terms of scale. I stand by exactly what I said then. I mean, obviously, this pandemic is not finished and we don't yet know the final death toll. But a much better comparison, it seems to me already obvious, would be one of the later flu pandemics of the 20th century, the 1957 so-called Asian flu, or the 1968 so-called Hong Kong flu. The first one, we estimate, killed no more than 2 million people. The second one, no more than 4 million people. Obviously, that's already a lot of people, but it's enormously less than the 1918 flu. So, you know, COVID-19, we hope very much that it won't kill anywhere near as many as 2 or even 4 million people. But the fact is that those are better references for comparison. So I think, you know, in terms of scale, we should be thinking of those other pandemics. That's not to say that there aren't historical parallels to be drawn. I think there are many similarities and many lessons we can take from 1918.
At the time, I mean, there was not a lot of knowledge on viruses and how exactly, I mean, they didn't have a cure for it, much like we don't have a cure for COVID-19 now. So a lot of what was done to mitigate the effects of the Spanish flu were non-pharmaceutical. So things like quarantines, isolation, much like what we're doing today. So perhaps you could talk us through a little bit of that.
Yeah, so obviously flu is caused by a virus, and virus was a relatively new concept in 1918. The first viruses had been identified at the end of the 19th century, but it didn't take up a lot of their sort of psychological universe, even in the medical community. And so when the flu erupted in 1918, almost every doctor in the world, at least to begin with, assumed they were dealing with a bacterial disease. Vaccination was invented much earlier. They had the knowledge of vaccination and how to build vaccines. But the vaccines they built in 1918 were vaccines against bacteria, opportunistic bacteria that resided in the respiratory systems of patients. And that meant that they were, for the most part, ineffective. Sometimes they did have a little effect, because most of the people who died of the Spanish flu died of bacterial complications that caused pneumonia. So in other words, antibiotics also may have had an effect, except that antibiotics hadn't been invented, and nor had antiviral drugs. And the vaccines that they did make had a small effect, but really nothing very significant. And that meant that they had almost nothing with which to treat that disease. They did have aspirin, the so-called wonder drug, which can have an anti-inflammatory effect. Even aspirin they often gave in too high doses, causing, you know, aggravating the problem rather than ameliorating it. And that meant their best bet in terms of containing or slowing the disease or in saving lives were, as you say, non-pharmaceutical interventions, those interventions that we call collectively social distancing. So things like quarantine, isolation, wearing of masks, closing of schools. And as you very rightly point out, those are the same things we're using today. So for different reasons, because we do have knowledge of viruses, of course, we do have antiviral drugs and antibiotics, we also have a reliable diagnostic test, which they didn't have in 1918, and we have much better vaccine technology. But as you will have noticed, there is no vaccine at the moment. 18 months seems to be the most optimistic estimate for when we'll have one. The antiviral treatments that already exist and have been approved do not seem to be very effective against this virus. So the race is on to either repurpose those or find new ones that will effectively treat the disease. Antibiotics may have an effect, again, against those opportunistic bacteria. But we are, again, very vulnerable. We don't have a great deal in our medicine cabinet for treating this disease, which means that we're thrown back once again, as in 1918, on those non-pharmaceutical interventions. And of course, that's what you were seeing, in a sense, with lockdown. We've never done anything so dramatic as lockdown before in the history of humanity, but it was essentially a combination of measures that we've known about for a very long time.
So the other thing that I wanted to know about was, how did governments react to the Spanish flu of the time? Because, you know, there has been a lot of criticism aimed at government leaders for being either too slow to react or too early to react, depending on whether you're talking about lockdowns or reopenings of the economy. The Spanish flu was 102 years ago. So what kind of lessons might we perhaps draw from it?
Well, I mean, it was very variable and, generally speaking, not very effective. I mean, some parts of the world, they put in effective public health measures. The United States did a relatively good job, but even there, the picture was very variable across the country. In parts of Europe also. But these were also parts of the world. I mean, the world was a very different place at that time. And America and Europe were both deeply implicated in the First World War, at least at the beginning of the pandemic. And of course, even after the war ended, Europe was in a terrible state and there was the whole job of reconstruction to do. So, you know, at least to begin with, it wasn't many governments' priority. And that's why, you know, when you look at the 1918 pandemic, it's often, you know, it can feel like a pandemic that ran its natural course. Public health measures made a difference locally sometimes, but even when they did, they were often lifted too soon. A problem, of course, we're facing again today. And I think that, you know, in vast swathes of the rest of the world, there was really nothing to speak of in terms of effective interventions. And you have to remember that though most of our research and most of our storytelling about that pandemic comes out of the United States principally and then secondarily from Europe, those were not the continents that were the hardest hit. The continents that bore the brunt of that pandemic were Asia and Africa. And in those places, in those countries, the measures were were much less effective and in some places not put in place at all.
But I can imagine it would have been quite important for governments, particularly from countries like the US and the UK and France, to get a hold of this Spanish flu, because the flu targeted predominantly men, mainly in the prime of their life. So this would also have been the almost entire population of the militaries of that time. And considering it was a wartime era, preserving their standing armies would have been of significant importance, wouldn't it?
Yes, then there's absolutely no doubt that the armies were severely affected. But I think prosecuting the war was very much their priority. The attitude, I'm afraid, was that the losses were supportable. So, for example, you see President Woodrow Wilson of the United States, against the advice of his senior military doctors and at the urging of his generals, ordering that the troop transports crossing the Atlantic should continue. And so we read reports of horrible scenes on those ships as flu just plowed through the men who were, you know, sleeping in close quarters. The war took priority.
Now, Laura, I'd also just like to zoom in a little bit on the fact that we call this the Spanish flu. Now, this virus didn't actually originate in Spain, did it? So why is it called the Spanish flu?
That's a very important point because, you know, there are many open questions about the 1918 influenza pandemic. And one of the few certainties we have about it is that it did not start in Spain. So it comes back to this question of the war, and it's, you know, a kind of a clear illustration, which I think we're seeing again now in this current pandemic, of how political a pandemic is. At that time, of course, the political context was different. But when it erupted in the early months of 1918, the world was still at war, and the countries who were implicated in that war suppressed the information about this disease because they didn't want to lower the morale of their populations. At least that's what their cover story was. They censored the newspapers, and the newspapers were, of course, the main organ of dissemination of information at the time. Spain was neutral in the war, so it did not censor its press. And when the first cases of the flu occurred in Madrid in May of 1918, they were reported. And they included the King of Spain, Alfonso XIII, who went on to recover. But of course, his case lent it high visibility. And so it seemed both to Spanish people and to people in the rest of the world reading their newspapers that this disease was rippling out from Madrid. In fact, we know the cases had already been in, at least in America, France and Britain, probably in some of the Axis countries, and maybe even further afield by that time.
I'm speaking with Laura Spinney, a science journalist and author. Her latest book is titled Pale Rider, The Spanish Flu of 1918 and How It Changed the World. Up next, more lessons we can learn from the Spanish flu as it applies to the current COVID-19 pandemic. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking with Laura Spinney, science journalist and author. Her latest book is titled Pale Rider, The Spanish Flu of 1918 and How It Changed the World. Laura, so far we've covered, you know, what the Spanish flu is, whether or not it is actually a good comparison to the current COVID-19 outbreak. There was a lot of disinformation swirling around the Spanish flu. They said it was sown by German U-boats, I believe.
Yes, that was one of the stories. So, I mean, pandemics since the beginning of time have come hand in hand with xenophobia. There is this, you know, natural human tendency, unfortunately, to point a finger at the other. And at the beginning, you know, I think it's really interesting about how our understanding, how our memory, how our consciousness of a pandemic comes together. Because when it first emerged, it took a little while for people to realize that it was not lots of local epidemics, it was one big pandemic. So what you see at the beginning is lots of different names getting attached to it. So, for example, in Senegal, it was the Brazilian flu. In Brazil, it was the German flu. The Poles called it the Bolshevik disease, and the Danes thought it came from the south, which I think is quite sweet within the general xenophobic context, of course. Just blame whoever you can, essentially. The trouble is you have to be able to call it by something at the beginning because you've got to be able to deal with it. And that means you've got to be able to talk about it. You've got to be able to understand the nature of the problem and try and propose solutions. So it is really important to be able to call it by something. But the great dilemma always is that at the beginning, you don't know much about it. So it very often turns out that those early names give a wrong notion of the disease. And, you know, there have been various attempts to try and get around that dilemma. In 2015, the WHO came up with some guidelines for how to name diseases, which advised that you avoid naming it after countries, after subgroups of people, after foods, or giving it names such as fatal or unknown. But the trouble is that nobody can control the naming of a disease because it may be a journalist, someone like me, who comes up with a catchy name which spread. And, you know, obviously, Mr. Trump in this context has tried very hard to attach the name the Chinese virus unhelpfully. This happens every time. And I think that, you know, the WHO and all of us should consider it a victory that we managed to call this thing COVID-19 and that name has stuck, however banal and unmemorable it may seem.
What else did the Spanish flu particularly reveal when it came to the treatment of the vulnerable? And how does it compare to the treatment now?
So the other thing that seems to be characteristic of pandemics is that they reveal, you know, the fault lines in societies, the inequality in societies. In fact, there's even an argument, somewhat controversial, but it does exist, that pandemics tend to happen at times of great inequality. You know, it is abundantly clear from the statistics that we now have of the Spanish flu that it was the poorest, those who lived in the poorest accommodation and were malnourished, often immigrants, often ethnic minorities, those were the people who suffered worst in 1918. And that has not gone away, that we see again in this pandemic. If you think about the 2009 flu pandemic, there was a study that appeared about England, which showed that the poorest fifth of the population had a mortality rate during that pandemic that was three times higher than the richest fifth of the population. So these are stark contrasts, and pandemics highlight them every single time without fail.
And I guess pandemics can also highlight schisms in government, because how a government leader reacts and is able to drive public morale in the face of a crisis as large as a global pandemic can make or break political careers. So drawing from the history surrounding the Spanish flu, what can you make of the role of government leaders in weathering these kinds of global pandemics?
Well, this kind of touches on the psychology of pandemics, and I think it's really fascinating because basically what each one of us does matters in the, you know, shaping the trajectory of the pandemic. But what each one of us does depends on the trust we have in our leaders and the level of information we receive and, you know, whether those things combined make us want to comply with measures. Because, in democratic countries, nobody can oblige us to do anything. I mean, well, they can, but generally speaking, it's better if we do so of our own accord.
Yeah, you've written about the choice to comply and how important that can be in getting people to comply with these non-pharmaceutical interventions like quarantines.
And the thing is that if that trust is not in place by the time the pandemic declares itself, then it's probably too late. So, for example, you could talk about South Africa in 1918, where researchers have shown that when vaccines did become available, you know, I mentioned that vaccines were made, even though they didn't turn out to be that effective. People didn't know that at the beginning. They, you know, put their faith in them. And when a vaccination campaign was announced in South Africa, white people came forward to get vaccinated, but black people, generally speaking, boycotted it. And that's because the white colonial government had not shown much interest in their health previously, and they were now suspicious as to why they were suddenly so, you know, anxious to protect them. And so they just stayed away. And there were all sorts of rumors that circulated about white men trying to kill them with their long needles and so on. And so I think that's quite a good example. Or you could look at somewhere like the States, which was a completely different context. There, people had quite good trust in their leaders in general and were relatively well informed about, you know, the reason that the public health measures were being put in place. But over time, that trust kind of fizzled away because they saw that their doctors were fairly helpless against this disease. They saw that the vaccines were pretty ineffective. And so the compliance rates started dropping off. And so it's a very delicate thing that depends implicitly on the trust that exists between people and their leaders. And in fact, having spoken to some health ministers and people, you know, with important roles in public health during this current pandemic, it seems to me that the governments that have done well are the ones where they've presented a kind of whole government front, you know, where all the parts of government are united in conveying the same messages and in supporting each other and in and putting forward the same public health view of the situation, being very transparent. Those are the ones that have done best, generally speaking.
So how do we ensure that compliance rates continue to stay high, particularly as countries that have been under restricted movement orders, they are seeing those restricted movement orders lifted? I mean, there is a very prevailing sense of, oh, you know, now we can move about, therefore things are going to go back to normal, when that isn't actually the case, when case numbers are still high and could still spark a second wave. How do we maintain that level of public buy-in, particularly if COVID-19 is similar to the Spanish flu and takes 2 to 3 years to run its course?
So we don't know, of course, what course it will run. And there are dangers in comparing it to flu because it is a different disease. We have to understand it on its own terms. And, you know, that's what the scientists are trying to do very hard at the moment. You're absolutely right that we are in a new normal, and it's for us all to accept that we can't go back to the old normal for some time, if ever. Understanding that will depend on a number of factors, I think. Again, trust that exists between people and their governments, but also, you know, governments giving back. You have to be able to support your people because, you know, their compliance depends on the fact that they can themselves continue to survive and feed their families and so on, pay the rent. There has to be good information, transparency, all of these things go into shaping compliance and become almost more important as time goes on.
All right. And so, Laura, do you have any perhaps final things to say when it comes to how do we escape repeats of history when it comes to this COVID-19 pandemic?
I mean, flu is considered generally the most pandemic-prone disease. We've had 15 flu pandemics in the last 500 years. And so pandemics happen. We know they will happen again. We don't yet have the scientific knowledge that allows us to predict when the next one will happen, what exactly will be the cause, because this current pandemic shows it doesn't always have to be flu, or how bad that pandemic will be. But we do know that there'll be another one, and we should act on that knowledge, and we should not forget this pandemic as soon as it's passed, and we should put in place those measures that the WHO and other organizations have been urging us to put in place for a very long time, and that we haven't. Making, for example, our health infrastructure more robust, more pandemic ready. And that means not just in our own countries, but across the world, because as this pandemic is showing yet again, all of us are only ever as safe as the least safe place. These are just lessons that we should not forget and that we should action, if you like, outside the pandemic, rather than always panicking when a pandemic strikes as if, you know, this was so unexpected, and then forgetting it as soon as it passes again.
So is this the big one that epidemiologists and infectious disease experts have been warning about for so long?
Well, we don't know, do we? And the fact is, it could have been worse. If you think about a related coronavirus, Middle East respiratory syndrome, which is still causing people to fall sick in the Middle East, then that has a much higher mortality rate than this coronavirus. If that had become a full-blown pandemic, and it's not impossible that it still could, or some other coronavirus like it, we would have been seeing a much worse situation than this. So, you know, I don't know if that's going to happen or if it's even likely to happen. Let's hope not. But it is at least a theoretical possibility. And so in some ways, we could think of ourselves as having been lucky. Doesn't feel like it at the moment, I know. But there are things we could do to prevent such a scenario from happening. And let's hope that we realise that and we do it after this.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us this morning, Laura. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Thank you for your questions, Lynn.
I've been speaking with Laura Spinney, science journalist and author. Her latest book is titled Pale Rider, The Spanish Flu of 1918 and How It Changed the World. I'm Lynn Mark and this has been The Breakfast Grill, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.